to Inside Scoop 5. Hi, I'm Irene Watson. I'm your host for today. Well, today I'm really delighted to be speaking on the phone with Troy Parfit, Canadian author of Why China Will Never Rule the World, Travels in the Two Chinas. Having lived in China and Republic of China, Troy set out to test the theory that China is ascending toward the position of global domination. He found out something different, and he's going to be sharing his experience and his research with us today. Hi, Troy.
Hi, Irene.
This is going to be an interesting topic to talk about, but before we go any further into really finding out why China can't rule, I want to know, first of all, how you ended up going to China in the first place and living there for the 10 years you did.
I actually lived in Taipei, Taiwan, for 10 and a half years. Taiwan is at its closest, 160 kilometers from China. So I actually lived in Taipei, Taiwan, the Republic of China. And for the research for the book, I only spent something like 3 months in China itself, although I had lived in China or had stayed in China for a month previously. So in total, I only have about 4 months living in China, although I've got 10 and a half years experience living in Chinese society, because Taipei, of course, the capital of Taiwan, is Chinese. So it was there that I became, you know, immersed in Chinese culture and studied the language and worked for Chinese companies and things like that. And living in Taiwan gave me a kind of a unique perspective on China, like a front row seat sort of thing. It's, you know, China's featured in the news every day in Taiwan for political reasons and mainly. I kept hearing about how, you know, China was going to rule the world and whatnot, and how this idea was really kind of gaining credence in the West. And I kept thinking, you know, which China? The one, you know, the one across the Taiwan Strait? That one over there? Are they talking about another one? It just didn't compute with me, because I knew that. You know, that Taiwan, Republic of China, was, as a comparative model, was, you know, superior to China, you know, People's Republic of China in terms of, you know, society, in terms of progress and so on. But in terms of, you know, leading the Western world anywhere or something, it was, you know, on a road to nowhere. I mean, the culture is valid on its own terms to Chinese people, but it doesn't integrate well with non-Chinese culture. So I knew and also from reading and from observation that China, you know, going to rule the world had to be a myth. And so I ventured off to China for 3 months of travel to show that it was.
So you, while living in Taipei, you said that you had that front row seat.
Yeah.
Of observing, and so living there and observing, how is that affecting you living in Taiwan, Republic of China?
Well, it gives you a firsthand view of what Chinese culture and society is. You know, you're not, it's something, you know, I think a writer recently, Paul Theroux, said something like, you know, you can't Google the world. And it's kind of true. You know, you can observe China from a distance and, as of course anyone who lives in North America has to do, unless you go there for business or something. But in order to really, really understand it, you have to jump in. You know, you have to, you know, surround yourself with the culture, and so you really get you're really on the inside track. And I think just, you know, observation and of course your daily experiences, but also you need to supplement that with a lot of research and a lot of. Western people do that when they go to Taipei. They become interested in Chinese studies and Chinese language and Chinese history, as I did. And you go to the bookstore, and there's a fantastic selection of English language books on Chinese culture and history and so on. And I just kept reading them and reading them and reading them, as a lot of Westerners tend to do. So I think, but yet I was still. And then I was free to read those books, because if I had lived in China, I could have probably ordered them or something online or something, but I couldn't have bought many of them in China, you know? So so you have the luxury in Taipei of having complete free access to, you know, to information. So that was a bonus, certainly.
So you just mentioned that you could buy these books in Taipei, and they were English written, obviously.
Mm.
But who actually wrote these books? Were they actually the Chinese people or observers?
Most the stuff that you want to read, if you really want to understand China, is the history stuff. Now, that scares a lot of people because they think, you know, oh, God, the last thing I want to do is read about Chinese history. They think of, you know, 5,000 years of, you know, imperial times, dynastic times. But the really interesting bits of Chinese history are the last, like, 175 years. And this has been that's really fascinating. Like 20th century Chinese history, you know, the history of China in the 20th century is absolutely fascinating. I mean, I've read, you know, American 20th century history. I've read probably the history of about maybe a dozen or maybe up to 20 countries of the 20th century. They don't compare to what's going on in China in the 20th century. But those books are written by Western historians and Western observers because they're mainly academics and because they're impartial. Because if you buy history books written in Taiwan, written by Taiwanese academics, they'll probably have a bias. They might not, but they could be associated with the Nationalist Party in Taiwan. They could have even been commissioned by the Nationalist Party to write a history book with a spin on it. And if you buy stuff in China, it's going to be basically just communist. You know, it's going to have a communist slant to it. So the what's read is material written by mainly British and American writers who observers, missionaries, a whole host of people, educators and diplomats, and mainly historians like Yale historian Jonathan Spence, who's British, but he teaches at Yale. He's a top writer, for example, and many others. There's a long list.
You said you worked for Chinese companies.
Yes.
And so what was that? Now you're back in Canada and, of course, working for Canadian companies.
Mm-hmm.
What was the difference for you between working for a Chinese company as working for a Canadian company?
Well, I'm a teacher. I'm an English teacher by training. So when I say companies, I mean schools, but I work for private language institutes, which run like companies.
Company,
you know, and so, but I don't know. I think that like, for example, the quality of equipment, for example, like the kind of, there's a lot of funny business that goes on, I suppose you could say, like the president of one company that I worked for was ridiculously stingy. Like, for example, office furniture would be, you know, I think he got it from the trash or something. He was one of the richest people in Taiwan. I mean, he was a millionaire and probably many times over. But and the computers were like yellow, sort of, you know, moldering with kind of rot. And I mean, they make them, you know, just in the next town, and they're cheaper. And, you know, and of course in Canada, it's very similar to the United States. You know, you have probably better equipment, or there are formal procedures, and it's all cultural, I suppose. But it was actually very hard to work in Canada after working in Taiwan for so long, because in Canada there are a different set of there's rules and there's political correctness, and that doesn't exist in the Chinese world. So
really?
I actually found it a bit of a rough ride coming back to try to integrate and to read myself to the Western way of doing things.
So I'm curious, what political correctness that you have in Canada that you didn't have in Taiwan?
Well, to give you an example, I was in my office here one time in Canada, and I was friends with the guy who was the custodian, and he'd come in and clean up, and we'd talk about, so did you see the hockey game last night or whatever, and I referred to him once as the janitor. I called him the janitor, and to one of my staff members, and they took me aside very seriously and said, this is in a university setting, and said, you know, we don't call those people janitors. I didn't know that the term had changed over time, and that janitor was now an unacceptable term, and just things like that, and like in Taiwan, if you said, "Oh, I spoke to the janitor about whatever," nobody would care, or it just wouldn't matter. So, I guess there's a certain informalness or something to working in a Chinese company. Like, you don't have to dress well, for example. They don't really care about that. And just it's also more top down. I think that, like, in the West, you know who your boss is, but you can still talk to your boss like a kind of like peer-to-peer. Of course, it's always understood that, you know, you're what's expected of you and so on. But in the Chinese world, it's much more regimented and top-down. I mean, going to see the president of the company about to make a request or something is like a, you know, like a very big deal. You know, sir, can we please have another chair in the office? Thing like that. It's just very, very different. It's a whole other set of rules that you have to get used to.
Were you accepted as a Canadian?
I want to say yes, but not really. I mean, I was, you know, the Taiwanese are much, I think they're much more advanced than people in so-called mainland China in that regard. They're quite accepting. Like, people don't stare, and people, which was really surprising because I'd actually lived in another Asian country before that where people sort of stared all the time. And in Taiwan, they're kind of used to, or especially at least in Taipei, the capital, which is a bit more urbane, they were kind of used to seeing Westerners. But in the end, you're still considered a foreigner. And I think that's probably the thing that really sort of irritated me. I'd lived there for 10 years and I could speak the language pretty well. But every time I like went to the bank in front of my building to do some banking, you know, the tellers would say things like, oh, this foreigner's here again. He wants to, you know, and it's like, could you just call me Troy? I mean, you know, so, you know, and to think about, you know, in Canada, someone a Chinese Canadian went to a bank and a teller said, oh, that Chinese lady's here again. I mean, that wouldn't, you know,
right.
That'd be like a national news story or something.
Exactly.
So it's just like really different. And I think that you're just, but I mean, that's not exclusive to Chinese people. I mean, that's just the tribal nature of human beings. You know, outsiders are outsiders. Of course, in the West, we're more inclusive, and I especially here in Canada, we really strive for inclusiveness, and that's a real. It doesn't always work, of course, and there are problems, but that's a kind of a goal. But it's not really a goal there. You're always an outsider. To the dangerous. Of course, you're with your friends, they'll accept you just fine. But to people you don't know, you're always kind of an outsider. Yeah.
So, Troy, from the research you've done and from your experience living in China, why do you think that China is not going to rule the world, that this is just a myth and in somebody's dream or, you know, a rumor that's been spread around? Tell us what you really think and feel from what you've seen and researched.
Yeah, well, I think that that people are looking at it in entirely the wrong way. I mean, people tend to view it you know, only in terms of economics. You know, now they have money, you know, therefore, you know, they're the world's second largest economy. It's been predicted that they'll be the first largest economy by Goldman Sachs for the year 2027. And people, somehow, this notion is that as soon as that happens, they're going to be leading the way. But, countries that sort of, you know, rule the world, it's much more than just who's got money. I mean, the British Empire didn't become the British Empire solely because of how much cash it had in the national treasury or something. And the United States didn't become a world power solely because of money either. There are historical factors at play. I mean, with the United States, I mean, you know, World War II was a major sort of factor. I mean, America, you know, essentially won World War II and the Cold War, and has since helped to strengthen its global domination with everything from, you know, unfortunately, you know, gunboat diplomacy to foreign aid and charity to, you know, soft power, a whole list of factors, some of them good, some of them not so good. And the same thing with Britain. I mean, the British ruled most of the world because of, you know, brute force, and also very noble things like, you know, just education and the standards and protection and a whole a whole list of things. And China doesn't really possess any of those more favorable attributes that you know, for example, Great Britain did, or the United States. But it has cash, but it lacks the awareness to ever lead anyone anywhere, I think, in terms of the global stage. So it's really about culture, and that's the fact. That culture and mindset are really important, and they're never factored into the China's going to rule the world argument, unfortunately.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Inside Scoop Live is a global internet-based broadcast specializing in interviewing published authors about their current books and areas of expertise. I'm Juanita Watson, the host of the show, and invite you to join me as I bring to the air both well-known and upcoming writers. You will hear my guests talk candidly about their books, their life experience, specific topics, and the business of being an author in today's literary world. Always interesting and current, my intention is to bring our audience high-quality discussions that spotlight a vast diversity of authors in the field today. Our interviews are syndicated and archived for availability 24/7 through direct podcast and MP3 download. And as always, I love to hear from listeners. Have a look at our website, InsideScoopLive.com. Send me an email, comment on previous guests, and let me know who you'd like to hear on the show. I'll do my best to bring you your favorite authors live and direct.
Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Today I'm talking with Troy Parfit, author of Why China Will Never Rule the World. As you've heard so far, Troy's findings, opinions, and thoughts are things to really think about and possibly even do our own research. So stay tuned, because we're going to delve even deeper into recognizing the fact that China has no means of ruling the world, and it's only a myth. And when you talk about culture,
mm-hmm.
tell me exactly what it is that you mean.
Well, I think I'm referring to mindset.
Okay.
So I think that, you know, let's just look at, for example, or we can just go back to culture. Let's look at, for example, like soft, even just soft power appeal. Like, for example, when I lived in Taiwan, I was dating a girl who, for a number of years, whose mother didn't want to meet me because I was a Westerner. And then one day her mother started to watch the TV show Friends, you know, which was popular much later in Taiwan than it was in the United States, and she thought it was funny and she liked it, and her daughter and her daughter's friends would say, you see, you know, like Americans aren't such a bad bunch. I mean, how, they can't be that bad if they made a show that's funny and that appealing. And her mother kind of grudgingly conceded that, you know, maybe not all Western people were so awful or something like that. But there's a kind of like soft power appeal that from Great Britain and America still, that's really strong and pervasive in the world, and not to mention, you know, technology and education and medicine and so on and so forth. But those things just don't, those, like, China just doesn't have anything like that here. I mean, you know, how many Chinese music CDs do you have in your collection? Or when was the last time you saw a Chinese movie, or you watched a Chinese TV show? You know, you go to a bookstore and, you know, you'd be hard-pressed to find you could find a handful of Chinese authors, but it really wouldn't be very many. There's just not the appeal. And the practices and the way of doing things are so totally different from the way of that Western people do things, that it just wouldn't compute for Western people. That we'll never, you know, we'll never take instruction from China or adopt their way of doing things, because they just wouldn't have any appeal to Western people. Western people just wouldn't get it, and that's what it. I mean, there's a kind of international, there's a very loose sort of rough international standard whereby the West sort of, you know, sort of leads the way, and the world kind of follows in some very, you know, very, very sort of loose way. And that's, I see that as being the way that it'll probably be for quite some time.
Troy, just a little earlier as you were talking, you mentioned about myths.
Yeah.
And you cover a lot about this in your book. And it seems that what you're telling us, too, that there's just China's seems to be a collection of myths, and both Chinese and non-Chinese look at those myths, and they sort of put China, you know, in a certain category. Would you just kind of tell us about some of these myths that you have found?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, China's always been a kind of, like a very vague sort of blank slate onto which Western people have projected their own images without really sort of, you know, understanding what it's all about. And quite a few, and historically, you know, Western observers and, you know, doctors and politicians and advisors and missionaries and so on have sort of, you know, galloped off to China and thinking that they were going to, you know, change it or help the Chinese or educate the Chinese or whatever, only to realize that, you know, they're in way too much over their head and that they hadn't understood China really at all. And I think that, I don't know, it's for Western people, the East is a kind of a mysterious or inscrutable place or something, and we project these images. So there's just, it's fascinating because China is like, it's so many things that Western people think about that are in fact completely untrue. And to give you an example, it sounds like conspiracy theory, but it isn't. The Tiananmen Square massacre, you know, people, and I used to believe it too, that you know, there are hundreds of students gunned down within Tiananmen Square itself, which actually never occurred. And that has been reported subsequently by you know, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Guardian, and several other major you know, news stories. But I mean, here, you know, here in Canada, like for example, the anniversary of the so-called Tiananmen Square massacre, June 4th, they had a so-called expert on the CBC here in Canada talking, and you know, the reporter was asking this individual, you know, so tell us, what was it like to be there during the massacre? And of course, there actually wasn't a massacre in the square itself. There were people shot and killed all around the square, and there was a massacre of workers down the street. But not to say but, because of course it's a terrible thing. But it wasn't students, and you know, it's the Chinese government actually admitted that happened. It is rare that they admit that anything, you know, ever happened. So kind of, you know, for like the first time they actually, or so it can seem, that they actually tell the truth, you know, and then Western people don't believe them. It's been widely reported, and there's been a book written about it trying to correct this myth, but it just stays, and there's so many. And even the concept of the Great Wall, which, you know, people think of as this, you know, stegosaurus-backed wall, you know, rising and falling gracefully across two-thirds of the Middle Kingdom. There's actually, in fact, no such thing as the Great Wall. And two books have come out about this recently. One's called The Great Wall by, I think his name is John Mann. He's a historian. And there was another one by a female writer. And they both say the same thing, that there's never been anything approaching a Great Wall. There are a series of walls built by different leaders at different times for different reasons. Therefore, any statistics concerning the Great Wall are irrelevant. And why this persists, I don't know. It's just, it's something, it speaks to something about Western people, the way we see the outside world, or the way we see China, the way we imagine it. It's just, in almost every instance, the reality and what we think are often diametrically opposed. But that's the fascinating thing for someone who's like me, who's interested in Chinese studies, to find out the truth, because it's really, to me, it's really interesting, because the truth is almost always more interesting than the myth itself. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I just had a little learning experience here from you. So.
I'll send you the bill later.
You're funny. You seem to think that China is going to face some issues or problems, you know, in the next coming decades. And just from some of the things that I have read you've said, gives me that indication. And so what gives you that indication?
Well, I mean, you know, first of all, I mean, people make a big deal about its economy. I mean, well, they make a big deal about the the bottom line, the actual statistics. I think, you know, the economists or, you know, bean counters like to say, wow, it's really impressive. They made, you know, another, you know, 10% rise in the GDP this year or something like that. But what's behind those statistics is absolutely, you know, it's very disturbing. I mean, they, you know, essentially, you know, they've destroyed, you know, much of their environment or are destroying much of their environment. I mean, there's a, according to a writer named Rob Gifford, 75% of river water in China is now unfit for drinking or fishing. According to the New York Times, 1% of China's 560 million urban residents only breathe, only 1% breathe air that's deemed safe by the European Union. I mean, there are unbelievable pollution problems there. And that's another thing that Western people can't see. They can read about those statistics and they can think, oh, 1%, my goodness, that's terrible. The European Union said that their air is bad. How about that? But, I mean, you have to go there and you have to see it. You know, it's something that has to be really seen to be fully appreciated. When you can't see buildings across the street in the middle of a, you know, a sunny day, you know, there are towns in China, there are industrial towns in China where, you know, people seldom see sunlight because it's that polluted. And even in the middle of the countryside, like you take a train from one major city to another and you're just staring out the window in total amazement at, you know, how unbelievably dense the you know, and how bad the air is. It's absolutely, you know, shocking. And so, okay, so China's the factory floor, the world's factory floor. Everybody knows that. Okay, what's the next step? Can they become a, as I like to put it in a non-technical term, a more brains, less brawn type economy? And I just don't think that it can, or at least the transition to a more sophisticated economy where factories and pollution don't form the basis of that economy. To make that transition, I don't think it's possible. Or if it is, they're going to have one heck of a hard time doing it. Yeah. So pollution is one very serious problem.
It's interesting because, you know, now that you bring it up to light, of course we read about it, but, you know, we as Westerners are so hung up in our own stuff that's going on right now that we don't look at other countries and exactly what you just brought up, pollution. And, you know, I do remember seeing pictures of people in China walking with masks and, you know, and you just sort of, you see that, but it doesn't register. But now when you really bring it to light in this way, Yeah.
You have to go there. You have to experience it. You know, I can read about, you know, Venice. You know, I can Google map it. I can Wikipedia it. I can read a book about it. But I've never been there, so I can't really. So I don't really understand Venice. You know, it's like everything. You have to experience it on a deeper level firsthand to really. And unfortunately, you know, a lot of people in the West don't have that opportunity, or they're not inclined to. You know, just jump off. Well, I think I'll see what is going on over in China. You know, go take a holiday. So I guess I have to rely on, you know, written accounts. Yeah.
So do you think that, what do you really think of people globally? You know, the thought is that, yes, China is going to rule the world. You're saying no because of all these reasons. And it seems that probably the reason that a lot of us do think that is because of the ignorance, really, that we don't know. We just assume because of money. It's all about economics.
And that's a sad statement, I think, on humanity. You know, it's like, you know, if your neighbor's a gangster and has a really big, nice house, do all the, you know, does everyone in the neighborhood come out and say, wow, that's, you know, well done. You know, he's got a bigger house than I do. I mean, you know, it's what's behind that, and it's a very superficial analysis that's being given to the China analysis. And to be honest, you know, the media does. I mean, there are, you know, you can read decent articles in magazines and newspapers, but I would say that, generally speaking, they do a mediocre to very poor job at presenting, you know, presenting talking about this China argument. But I mean, they always have. Like, I mean, we thought that, you know, that the Soviet Union was going to, you know, said bury us, you know, and it turned out when it collapsed that, you know, they didn't have all the, you know, the ICBMs that were going to rain down on the United States and so on. You know, they didn't have as many, they hadn't tested them. Things actually on the ground in the Soviet Union didn't function. You know, communism, or at least their interpretation of it, it just didn't work. And that's the thing that we couldn't see because it was, you know, basically a closed society. So we didn't actually know. You know, and this is something like that. I think it's comparable to that situation. I mean, Western people who live in that part of the world, they hear the China to rule the world argument, and they just think, you know, that's ridiculous.
Totally
opposite. You know? Yeah, I mean, and, you know, I mean, it's not going to happen, but and it's become a really huge myth, and I think because. And people who endorse it, you know, these kind of, they often have a vested interest in seeing that China gain respect. And then I think because it's not kosher to criticize China in some regards. It's not acceptable to criticize other cultures. So a lot of people just shut up. A lot of people who know better don't say anything at all, and that's. Part of the reason, I mean, but I kind of I use the excuse that, you know, that Western, you know, Socratic questioning or academic investigation allows us to, you know, to question any subject at all. We shouldn't have to worry about, you know, hurting. I'm not responsible for hurting people, for people's feelings. You know, I mean, I just want to get to the nuts and bolts of the matter. I want to discover what the reality, what the truth is, what the reality is. So, and this is, you know, the conclusion that I've come to, I guess.
Well, you certainly have come to a conclusion that is worthy of reading, and I just encourage our listeners to check out Troy Parfait's book, and it is called Why China Will Never Rule the World. As you've heard so far, he's really come across a lot of pointers, and specifically because he's lived there for as long as he has. Troy, thank you very much for sharing all this with us.
Thanks, Irene. Thanks so much for having me on. Thank you.
And tell me your website address so that a listening audience can actually go to your website and check out more about you and your book and all the other things that you have on there.
Yeah, sure. My website is www, and then my name, which is Troy Parfit, and Troy, T-R-O-Y, Parfit, P-A-R-F-I-T-T. It's not that easy to remember right now. .com and if you do happen to find it, or you can just Google why China will never rule the world, and then you'll find it. And then when you're there, there's a free reading excerpt that you can read.
Great.
So, yeah. So thank you again.
Good, and thanks again. And listeners, this is Irene Watson with Inside Scoop Live. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.